session, class attendees. So welcome back to everybody who's here. I wanted to start discussing PERM today. PERM is in about 2.5 weeks from now. And this week we begin the month of Adar Sheni, the second Adar. And PERM is about 2 weeks from Thursday, right? So coming up soon. So 2 weeks from Wednesday night. So I'd like to discuss the topic today. Actually, the past few years we went through the Megillah in this class. So those who remember, chapter by chapter. So we finished that last year, so we're not going to start again. I could, but we're not going to. So I wanted to, this week, take a certain character from the Megillah and develop a little bit about who he was and what he stands for. And that character is Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, as we know, is the Persian emperor who was the beginning of the story of the Megillah. He was the one who began having these wild and crazy parties. The beginning of the story of the Megillah, he's the one who killed his wife Vashti. He's the one who married Esther. He's the one who agreed to Haman's plan to annihilate the Jews. He's the one who rescinded the plan at the end. That's Ahasuerus. In terms of who he was and when he lived, so I'm always terrible remembering dates, but I wrote down he's dated to have lived approximately in the Jewish year. Let's write down, where is it? 3392, which on the secular calendar is 368 BCE. 368 BCE. He's identified in English with somebody named, I think, Xerxes. Say it exactly. Xerxes the first, I think they call him. That's Ahasuerus. So that's who he was. Now, many people are taught, I know my kids in preschool are taught this, that he was very foolish, Ahasuerus. Kind of like a foolish, like a drunk, who was silly of what he did. And that's what he taught in school, who he was. But when you look at, actually look into sources as to who he was, how the sages portray him, he wasn't quite so foolish. We'll discuss, there is one opinion that calls him, in Hebrew, a tipesh, so somebody who's a little bit stupid or foolish. But most of what we have about Ahasuerus shows that what he did was very much planned out, methodical, and he was somebody who did have a lot of different ideologies and goals as an emperor. So we'll discuss who he was and how he relates to the Perm story. So let's begin. So he was the emperor of the Persian Empire. He ruled over, the Megillah says, 127 provinces, which at that time was essentially the entire known world. I mean, I don't know if it stretched all the way up to the Far East, and I don't know what was happening in terms of the American Indians in the Western Hemisphere. But the known world at that point, I mean, basically Europe and Africa, were all ruled by Ahasuerus. That was the Persian Empire at the time, which was the world power. The period in Jewish history when Ahasuerus is reigning is post the destruction of the First Temple. It's during the period of the first exile from the land of Israel. We call it the Babylonian exile. The Babylonians had destroyed the temple in approximately the year 3338 on the Jewish calendar. And then he is coming to power. This is approximately 60 years later, a little less 60 years later. So that's Ahasuerus' time. The Jews were exiled to Babylonia and eventually scattered throughout the Persian Empire during that time of history. This story of Purim will lead to the Jews returning to Israel and rebuilding the Second Temple. That's kind of the postscript of the Purim story. The Purim story ends with the Jews still living there in the Persian Empire, but it was Ahasuerus' son, Dariush, Darius in English, who gave us the permission to rebuild the temple and go back to Israel. So who was he? Where did he come from? Why was he the one who merited to become the Persian emperor? So the rabbis teach us, based on a verse in the Megillah, he was not of royal lineage. It says in the Megillah that, I mean, it begins saying it was the days of Ahasuerus. He is Ahasuerus HaMoleich, who ruled from Hodu to Kush. Hodu to Kush identifies two countries. In English, we usually look at Hodu as India, and Kush is Ethiopia, which is quite a expanse. But it's not necessarily clear that's what it refers to, but it then says 127 countries. So he ruled over a large area of land. So the first verse of the Megillah doesn't call him a king. It just, he was Ahasuerus, who ruled. So the rabbis point out, based on that and other points as well, that he was not of royal lineage. He was somebody who worked his way up to the monarchy. And the Talmud tells us because he was very wealthy. He was able to kind of pay his way into power. That's how he got there. And he ascended, so he used his money to gain power, and he ascended to power in the year 368 BCE, which was 3392 on the Jewish calendar. It's interesting, so his wife was Vashti. His first wife was Vashti. And Vashti was of royal lineage. Vashti was a daughter, or possibly granddaughter, I think a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian emperor, who the one who destroyed the first temple, and was also a world power. Because the Persians, they took the empire from Babylonia. And that was the transition of power in those days. So Vashti was of royal lineage, and Ahasuerus was not. So part of the idea of him marrying Vashti was he wanted to have his wife be of that lineage to kind of affirm his own personal power.
Why would she marry him?
Because he was the emperor. At that point, he was the emperor. So, but he wanted to have his ticket to fame through Vashti. I mean, he was always nervous that people were going to point him out and say, you know, you're not a king, you're not from a dynasty of kings, you have no experience as a king, and somehow they're going to usurp his throne. He was always nervous about that. So having Vashti as a wife helped him to kind of solidify his own personal rule and have that claim to the kingship. As an aside, it's interesting, the fact that he killed Vashti itself, that's part of the miracle. Because based on his own political reasons, he wants Vashti to stay alive. He doesn't like Vashti, because he needs Vashti to solidify his own reign. The fact that he married Esther later on, who he did not know where she came from, had no royal lineage to his knowledge, and he didn't know who her family was, that was very surprising, because he really wanted to concretize his rule, and having a queen without royal lineage for him was not getting him to that point, wasn't accomplishing his goals. But in any case, so Vashti was of royal lineage. Vashti came from Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the emperor of Babylonia, and therefore that was kind of his ticket to respect. Interesting to note as well, in the beginning of the Megillah, when they had this struggle between Ahasuerus and Vashti, so the story goes, he's holding one of his royal banquets, and he calls Vashti in to display her beauty. And she says, no, I'm not coming in. I don't want to be cheapened like that. So many commentaries point out in the verses of the Megillah at that point, there's one subtle difference made in a few different verses. It makes a big difference. Sometimes she's called in Hebrew Vashti Hamalka, Vashti the Queen, and sometimes she's called Queen Vashti. So if you pay attention closely, you might go through it now. The verses that she is kind of professing her own personal dignity, she says, I am Queen Vashti, because I am a queen first and foremost, and you're a nothing. Right? That's the implication. And when he calls for her, he says, Vashti the Queen, because first you're Vashti, only queen because of me. So that's kind of part of the struggle here. She's saying, what do you mean I'm a queen because of you? My father was the emperor. And he's saying, no, you're my wife, and you're nothing without me. And that's kind of the give and take between the two of them. So it goes back and forth. You can pay attention to the words between Vashti Hamalka and Hamalka Vashti, which kind of points out this concept that they were trying to fight over, who really does the power belong to? And who is the source of this great power of Ahasuerus? So you have the struggle with Vashti, and you end up killing her at the end. That's Ahasuerus. So this is kind of the beginning, or this is our first reading of Ahasuerus at this point. The Megillah continues and discusses, yeah.
Could it be that Vashti was kind of like a modest woman and had some virtue that she didn't want to be on display?
For sure. But part of it was she was stressing, I'm a dignified royalty. I'm a person of royalty, and how dare you even make that request of me? You're right. It could be she decided, I don't want to display myself because I'm a modest person. That's right. Certainly part of it. But she's also stressing to him, how dare you even make such an outlandish request from me, the queen? That it's beneath me. So the Megillah continues and discusses the great party Ahasuerus made. So I want to get back to that in a minute. But I want to read to you first. There's really two different takes you can take on Ahasuerus. One you get from reading the simple verses of the Megillah. You just translate the Megillah verse by verse to get one perspective on him. But if you look at the writings of the sages in the Gemara and the Midrash, so you find a little deeper perspective about Ahasuerus. So first I just want to share with you, the way we see Ahasuerus is based on the verses. And I'm going to read to you from Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Rav Hirsch has a lot of writings. A lot of his writings he has on the holidays of the year. And he has a whole chapters and chapters about Purim. And in those chapters about Purim, he discusses Ahasuerus a little bit. And he gives you the look at Ahasuerus kind of based on just reading the verses of the Megillah. And this is the way that we view him if we just kind of look at it on a superficial level and not see the words of the sages. So Rav Hirsch writes, Ahasuerus himself doesn't appear all that evil. He seems like a fine king. He seems to have a penchant for luxury. But that was pretty normal in those days. The royal pomp, an atmosphere of peace, that they aspire to the blood-sucking laurels of military glory, etc. He gives a description. He likes to drink. He doesn't drink alone. He always drinks with others at parties. He doesn't want to have all his advisors or princes around him. He's very gracious and affable. he offers to them, would you like to drink with me? Can I provide a party for you? He invites everyone to the parties. He doesn't just make his parties for his own personal family and entourage. He invites all people to this party. They feast together at open banquets. And, you know, he does more than just having them observe him dine. They dine together. So he seems to be somebody who wants to do good for the people. And we find in the Megillah that he reduces taxes at times for royal gifts to people, which is nice. And he cares about law and order. He does consult with his advisors in terms of what was proper justice for certain situations. He has advisors with him all the time who know about law. He has it, like his Supreme Court justices, as it were, with him on his side, who always answers questions in terms of the proper law and order. So that all seems pretty good. Ahasuerus himself seems to be pretty good-natured and kind and caring. He rewards those who do good for him. He punishes those who go against him, like a typical king. But then we say that until he gets drunk. When Ahasuerus gets drunk, which a lot of the story revolves around him being drunk, when he gets drunk, he becomes a little bit different. Everything hinges on his mood and temper of the moment. If the queen wishes to plead with the king in the name of justice and humanity to spare the lives of thousands of innocent people, she must give a banquet and wait for a moment when the king is in a good mood before she may just safely dare to state her request. Despite the fact that he seems to be a giving king, he doesn't even let his own wife come in and make a request of him, even when it's on behalf of thousands of people, without getting him happy at a banquet. So we see something about him. He doesn't have control over his own emotions. He's somebody who's very moody. And the truth is, he didn't really have much control over his own empire, because Haman sways him one way, Esther sways him a different way. He keeps being swayed back and forth as to what to do. So that's what you see from many of the verses of the Megillah. So he then writes that no one's allowed to come near him without being summoned or condemned to death, as we see in the Megillah. If you appear in the king's chamber dressed in the sackcloth of mourning, you're also going to be killed, because the sorrows of the world outside must not enter the rooms of the royal palace. So he kind of did live aloof in his palace, and what was going on outside didn't really matter to him. So he's nice to people, and he rewarded them, but he wouldn't hear about their troubles and sorrows without his permission. And then Haman's able to come in and persuade him to commit genocide, essentially. And in a moment, he reverses back to killing Haman and saving the Jews. So we find that there's a tremendous lesson here in Ahasuerus throughout the Megillah, which is that the Jews experience the full impact of the misery that lies in store for them whenever the weal and woe of men depend upon the pleasure or displeasure, the moods and the whims of the ruler. Ultimately, it came down to his own moods and whims. You know, as much as you see about Ahasuerus, what you see about him most in the Megillah is that if he's happy and drunk, he'll do X. If he's a bad mood, he'll do Y. He storms out of the palace, he comes back in, and he screams, kill him, and do this to him, and save her. And he seems to be somewhat impulsive and somewhat moody, as we see in the Megillah. But that's kind of the picture of Ahasuerus in the Megillah. So he's somebody who does follow law, who does try to help out and do good for others, but yet he kind of runs his country based on his own mood and impulses, and based on how he's feeling at the time, not based on any broader plan or vision. So that's what we see in the Megillah. But if you look at the Gemara, and you look at the writings of the sages, you see a very different aspect of Ahasuerus. So I want to get into that a little bit. So the Megillah begins with this tremendous party being made by Ahasuerus. And the party was essentially a display of his wealth. Read the verses in the Megillah, it talks about the beautiful vessels they use, and the carpets, and the walls, and the floors, and just an incredible party, 180 days long. The 7-day party, then 180 day party. 180 days straight a party, that's quite a party. To imagine the amount of money and wealth that was spent on that party is incredible. The Gemara tells you he was kind of money hungry, and he did charge a lot of taxes, does say that. His name is Ahasuerus Hebrew, which the rabbis say is actually an allusion to the word rush, which means to be poor, because he made everyone poor during his days. He taxed so much, his taxes were so high, everybody came poor in his days.
He seems to be contradicting that other list that you read, where he said he cut taxes.
He cut taxes when he went to reward somebody.
By what?
When he went to give rewards, he cut taxes.
There was another list portraying him as a good guy.
That's what I was saying, because when he went to reward you, he cut your taxes. But the standard was high taxes. That was the standard. It says in the Megillah, when Esther came to power and he was excited, he cut taxes at that point. And at the end of Megillah, he raised the taxes again. And Megillah discusses his tax plans. But in general, he charged very high taxes, and that's how he could pay for his royal parties. And how did he pay for a party like that? It was through all that tax money. the Megillah even ends, as we said, that he charges more taxes. That's how the very second to last verse of the Megillah is he raised taxes. That's what it was. He was certainly a hedonistic, you know, pleasure seeker, always trying to look for his own personal pleasure. The rabbis compare him. There's a verse that says, "Dov shokik." There is a bear who is like yearning for food, and Achashverosh is compared to that bear. It says this is the Persian Empire in general, and Achashverosh in particular, that they were just looking for pleasure after pleasure. You know, this party was one big pleasure fest. That's what this party was. With food and drink and women, everything else. That's what he's looking for. So he's referred to by the sages as, based on a verse in the prophet, is a dove shokik, a bear which is just yearning to fill his own appetite. It's hard to see this in the Megillah, but the rabbis teach us, and you actually find this in the book of Ezra, that Achashverosh himself was a major anti-Semite and was wicked at the core. In the Megillah, you don't see that he's wicked. You see him kind of being, you know, manipulated by his advisors. But the rabbis teach us that another hint you have in his name, Achashverosh, is that if you heard his name, you would say, Ach Leroshi, which means like, Oyvei, that's what it means. Because Ach Roshi, Achashverosh, because he was somebody who was so evil, did such terrible things to the Jews, you heard about it, you would say, Oyvei, not him again. It says that he had very much in common with his I guess not his predecessor, but yeah, a few emperors before, Nebuchadnezzar, who was the emperor of Babylonia, who was considered a tremendously wicked person and destroyed the first temple, exiled the Jews, and killed probably tens or hundreds of thousands of people. They're compared by the sages. He was somebody who had the same drives and the same hate for Jews as Nebuchadnezzar did, which shows that he wasn't just this like simple king who enjoyed seeking pleasure. He actually did have plans to have it out for the Jews. So he's portrayed as somebody who's kind of power hungry and wicked, and it's actually an explicit verse in the book of Ezra. It's very interesting that the Jews, we'll talk more about this later, but the Jews were actually committed to rebuild the temple earlier on. During the reign of Koresh, of Cyrus, who was the first, I think, of the Persian emperors, he actually was a big fan of the Jews. And he said, you can go back, you know, he very much, you know, gave honor to Hashem. That's the way it's portrayed throughout the prophets. And he let the Jews go back to rebuild the temple. And they went back to Israel for 2 years, a large group of Jews, and started rebuilding the temple. Achashverosh came to power, and he stopped it. He said, you may not build the temple anymore. And it says, that the wording used in the book of Ezra, it says, Kasav Sitna. He basically wrote letters of hate, and of blame and prosecution against the Jews, sent them throughout the entire empire. At that point, he made a stop building the temple, and the temple laid there, just partially built, for decades at that point. And it says he would have destroyed it had he could have. I mean, had there been a temple, he would have destroyed it. That was his attitude towards the Jews. Because there wasn't a temple, all he could do is stop the reconstruction of the temple. But he is somebody who, at heart, would have destroyed the temple had he could have. You find this as well. There's an analogy given in Gemara, between Haman and Achashverosh. So Haman comes to Achashverosh, and this is in the third chapter of the Megillah, and tells him, there's a nation out there who's scattered and rebellious, let's kill them out. And Haman tells Achashverosh, don't worry, I know you'll lose out a lot of your tax money from these people because they want your money. So here's a large sum of money to kind of cover their taxes. And Achashverosh says, no problem, kill them out and take the money back, I don't need their money. So the rabbis give an analogy. They say it's like two people. One person has a huge amount of dirt in his yard, and one has a major pit in his yard that needs to be filled up with dirt. So two get together, and one guy says, do you have a pit? I have dirt, perfect. And they make a deal, and you know, the dirt goes and fills the pit, and finished. So I'm not sure for that saying, but they're the analogy. That they both view the Jews, whether it be as an annoying mound or as a pit in your yard, they both hated the Jews. When they got together and figured out a way to kill us, they said, great, let's make a deal. And he said, I don't need your money, just take the dirt, you know, essentially. That's the analogy given. So Achashverosh hated Jews just as much as Haman did, it seems. Additionally, the rabbis teach us, so Esther comes into Achashverosh to make her a big request. And Achashverosh is uncertain why she's there. And he says to her, you know, what can I do for you, my dear queen, Esther Amalka? Up to half the empire can be yours. So the sages say, why is he offering her half the empire? What does he mean by that? So the sages tell us, what he meant was, I'll give you anything you want, just not the temple. Do not ask me for the Jews to rebuild the temple, I'm not allowing that to happen. That's what he says. So this was something which is on his mind throughout his entire reign. That temple cannot be rebuilt. I don't want the Jews to have that building and to have that tower. And he said to Esther, anything you want, just don't ask me to rebuild this Mikdash. I'm not allowing that. So he had a problem with the Jews. And I want to try to understand a little bit, what was his problem with the Jews exactly? Haman we know more about. Because Haman in the Megillah tells us, was upset with Mordechai not bowed down to him. That's very clear in the Megillah. Haman we also know is a descendant of Amalek, Mishnah Amalek, which Amalek is in the Torah, the quintessential and the center. They are a nation that their whole existence is here to destroy what Jews believe in. That's how the Torah depicts Amalek. So for Haman, we don't need much of an excuse. Haman comes from the nation of Amalek. He hates Jews as an Amalekite. And Haman also, we know, was upset with Mordechai for not bowing down. So Haman we're okay with. Achashverosh, we see this tremendous hatred coming from Achashverosh, and we don't know why. So what did the Jews do to him? Like, why does he hate the Jews so much? He wasn't from Amalek. He was just Persian, you know. We don't really have much interaction with Jews prior to Esther and Mordechai. I don't think we're aware of such interactions. So what was it that made him hate the Jews so much? So I want to explain to you is based on a few commentaries, namely the Maharal's commentary on the Megillah, but others say it as well. But there's a central point of understanding Achashverosh, which comes out in this discussion. As I mentioned before, Achashverosh began from very humble roots. He was not of royal lineage. And he worked his way up. And his entire time as king, he was always concerned for his power, because they're going to out me. They're going to say, you know, you don't know what you're doing, you're inexperienced, you don't come from a royal family, and they're going to somehow take over his kingdom. So there's something which is always on his mind. He was obsessed with it in certain ways. So a lot of things he does in the Megillah are trying to concretize and solidify his power, his reign, his kingdom. He lived during what we call Galus Babel, the exile from Babylonia, which when the Jews were now spending their time in Babylonia and Persia in between the two temples in Israel. So during that time, the rabbis tell us, and said in the prophets, that all the kings of the world were very nervous. And they're all very nervous because everybody had known the power of the Jews during the first temple period. Everyone knew our kings, the miracles that we had, the majesty of the temple, the prophets. Everybody recognized that as something of significance. When the Nebuchadnezzar, when the Babylonians came in and destroyed the temple, everyone was shocked. How could it be that this tremendous country, these kings, this building could be destroyed by a human being? We saw centuries of holiness, of miracles, of God's protection. The whole world recognized that. How could it be? They're all shocked. And there was a prophecy by the prophet Jeremiah, which said that for 70 years the Jews will be exiled and they'll go back to their lands. So all the ancient kings are very nervous about this prophecy, because they said, oh no, they're going to all go back to their land, and they're going to take revenge against us, take over our empire. They're very nervous, because they knew the power of the Jews and the power of God. They recognized that. We'll get to later this account of 70, how there's a lot of people made mistakes in counting the 70. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But Achashverosh was also concerned. He was very concerned. He was threatened by God. I want to be the world power. I want the power to be mine. I want to concretize my reign, make everyone recognize me. And if the Jews go back to Israel and rebuild the temple, then as long as God is there, then somebody's in my way. God's my opposition. Because everyone knows if the Jews are in Israel and they have their temple, we see the majesty of God's kingdom, then every single other ruler in the world is kind of downgraded. Achashverosh was power hungry and wanted to make sure he had the recognition. Reestablish their power, because that's going to threaten my power. In the feast he makes at the beginning of the Megillah, so the sages tell us that he wore the clothing of the Kohen. He wanted to say, this is your new temple, forget about this. They actually brought out the vessels that they had taken from the temple. The Babylonians, when they destroyed the temple, they took all the vessels, and they were there in the treasury of Babylonia, and the first to go over Babylonia, so they got all the temple vessels. that at this meal, at this great feast, at this great party, they serve the food of the vessels of the temple. I'm trying to say again, that this is your new temple. Don't worry about Jerusalem. It's all about me, Achashverosh says. The term used to describe Achashverosh's, capital, more like his royal fortress, is called Shushan HaBira. Shushan HaBira. So in modern Hebrew, the Bira is the capital city. It means the capital in the Megillah. It's disputed what the word actually translates to. But it certainly means like the royal fortress, not the capital city. And it's referred to as Bira. The other place you'd find referred to as Bira is the temple itself. There's a few references throughout the Tanakh, but the temple is called the Bira. He's saying, this is your new Bira. This is your new temple. So ignore everything else. The power is mine. The respect is mine. I want it all. The sages tell us, how did he end up in Shushan exactly? The capital of the Babylonian Empire was in Babylon, I guess. It wasn't in Shushan. Shushan was a Persian city. I think in English they call it Susa. S-U-S-A, Susa. English. It still exists today. I guess somewhere in Iran, I think. But Shushan was not the capital initially. He moved the capital to Shushan. Why did he do that? The sages say that Achashverosh coveted the throne of King Shlomo, King Solomon. He wanted to sit in that throne. Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, had an incredibly beautiful throne, gold and silver and marble with all these animals and everything else. An amazing throne. And the sages say that this throne actually had spiritual power to it. And when somebody who was not of the divine kingship tried to ascend the throne, the lion would actually attack. So he'll descend the throne. So Achashverosh really wanted to sit in this throne of King Solomon, but couldn't do it. So he hired workers to make a replica of the throne. They had this throne. Yeah, they had this throne. Because they don't. They had the throne. Because when they destroyed Jerusalem, so they had this throne, but they couldn't sit on it. So he had workers replicate the throne. But the workers he found were at Shushan. That's where the workers lived. And they built the throne. And it was such a large throne to move. He decided, I'd rather move the capital around the throne than move the throne to the capital. That's what he said. So he basically made a new capital centered around this throne. That's what sages tell us. But why did he want to sit in King Solomon's throne? So part of it was just his own personal honor, the beautiful throne. But on a deeper level, it's because he wanted to take over that position in the world. King Solomon was God's appointed king. It says that King Solomon sat on the Kisei Hashem, the throne of God. But he was God's messenger in this world. So Achashverosh says, no way, we can't have that. I'm going to be God's messenger in this world. I can't have somebody else have the power. I want to sit on that same exact throne. The sages even say he served food from Israel. Israeli food. He can't put a falafel or something. Like, he serves Israeli food at his meals. Or shawarma, hummus, I don't know. But and the point was, this is the new Jerusalem. This is the new Israel. This is the new temple. I am the new King David. Forget about God. Forget about your Beis HaMikdash. We don't need any of that. The power is all mine. He included elements of the Mishkan, of the temple itself, in his palace. I'm not going to go through the different references, but there are certain, if you look at the materials used, in his palace, it's very similar materials to the Mishkan. I read about the parsha the past few weeks. He described the destruction of the Mishkan. And all the different colors, the materials. So the same materials are found in his palace. He's trying to replicate a temple, as he's trying to do. When he made his great feast, he even served kosher food, he says. He served kosher food. He wanted to make the occasion a celebration for all. To know that this is me, I'm the one in charge. Everyone's part of my empire now. I'm going to be good to all of you, but respect me as your king and forget about anything else. That's what he wanted. So on a deeper level, you see the sages are portraying him as somebody who wanted to sweep up all the power of the world and even usurp the power of God, as it were. That's what he wanted to do. And he knew if the temple was rebuilt, then I'm going to be threatened by God's power. He knew that. He knew that very well. Why was the party made at this point? So this is the third year of his reign. And it says that at this point, he felt the 70-year prophecy was up. I want to discuss this prophecy. Jeremiah the prophet, who was the prophet who lived through the destruction of the temple, he said that the exile will last for 70 years, and then the Jews will return to Jerusalem. That was his prophecy. This prophecy was known by all the ancient kings, and they were very nervous about it, because they didn't know what would happen to them if the Jews would return to Israel. They weren't sure what would be their fate if that happened. So many of the kings tried to calculate the 70 years, and so they would know when the 7 years was up and realize that Jeremiah was, saying things which were false and not to worry anymore. So the Gemara explains to us, now let's go through a few of the details. A few kings, well, two kings, I guess, to try to calculate the 70 years, and he miscalculated it. The first king was Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the successor to Nebuchadnezzar, who's a Babylonian emperor. And he was the final Babylonian emperor. After Belshazzar was assassinated, and at that point the Persians took over the empire. But Belshazzar, who was the successor to Nebuchadnezzar, he said, he was nervous, it's still the 70 years, nervous he's going to be assassinated, killed, whatever, and the Jews go back to Israel. So he made his own calculation. And he said, when Jeremiah said, it's for 70 years of Babylonia, you return back to Israel, he thought it meant 70 years from the rise of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the Babylonian emperor who destroyed the temple. He said, 70 years starts when he rises to power. After 70 years from that point, the Jews go back to Israel. So 70 years pass, and Belshazzar and the Jews are still here in exile in Babylon. He says, great, Jeremiah was wrong. The Jews aren't going back to Israel. This is part. And what happens is, on the morning after that party, he was assassinated. He was wrong in his calculation, and he was killed, and the empire then went on to the Persians. So that was the first time that calculation was made wrong. Next came Achashverosh said, oh, Belshazzar got it wrong, but I'm going to get it right. He said the 70 years that were predicted by Jeremiah should be counted not from the rise and power of Nebuchadnezzar, but from the exile of King Yechonia. Yechonia was one of the final Jewish kings. What happened was, when the Babylonians came into Israel, they didn't destroy the temple immediately. They first essentially made Israel into like a puppet state of Babylonia. And they put in their own kings. So the last Jewish king, there's one more, Sikhiyazu, but the one before that, his name was Yechonia. And Yechonia was exiled by Nebuchadnezzar and taken in chains and put in prison in Babylon. So Achashverosh thought the 70 years will begin from the downfall of that king, Yechonia. He counts 70 years from Yechonia's exile when he's put into prison taken to Babylon. When those 70 years pass, that means that Jeremiah was wrong and they can celebrate. So the Megillah begins with that party. Achashverosh has counted 70 years was up. And he looks around, the Jews are still here in Shushan, there's no temple, there's no Jews over here, not in Israel, I can celebrate, because there's no more threat from God. And that's when he makes this major party and brings out all the vessels of the temple, and there's the clothes of the Kohen, and he does it like we would describe, because at this point he sees God's not threatening anymore. I am the new God, as it were. My palace is the new temple, we're going to celebrate, and I'm going to be the world power, you know, until the day of my death. That's what Achashverosh felt. So he made this major feast in the meeting of the Megillah. He was also wrong, because the 70 years themselves actually were counted, as the Gemara tells us, from the destruction of the temple. That's their counting from. So 70 years following the destruction of the temple, this is in the year 3338 of the Jewish calendar, that's when Achashverosh's son, Darius, Garyavish, he gave orders to the Jews to rebuild the second temple. So that's what happened. So the 70 years were actually supposed to be counted from the destruction, not from Nebuchadnezzar's rise to power, not from Yechonia's exile. So at this point in the Megillah, Achashverosh is celebrating the 70 years being completed. That's what he's celebrating right now. See, 70 years is up, now I can celebrate because God is no longer going to bother me. He says, I can rest assured the Jews will not rebuild the temple, not going back to Israel. My kingdom is complete, in opposition. And in this party, has now become the alternative to God. Or I am the alternative. Forget about God, I'm going to be the alternative. That's what this is the backdrop to the first party of the Megillah. So this is a much different take on Achashverosh than you get when you're a priestly, foolish king, you know? He had a plan. You know, he was foolish in the sense that he was kind of fickle. He can be influenced back and forth by his advisors, by his food, by his drinking. That is foolish. That part is foolish about him. But deep down, he was not a nice guy. He wasn't a stupid guy. He was a very wise person with wicked intentions when it came to the Jews. That's who he was. Power hungry, he was a pleasure seeker, and ultimately, yes, when he got drunk, he did get swayed by those around him, but that's just one small part of Achashverosh's personality. I think this is a symbol for many of the challenges that we have in life overall. So Achashverosh was saying, there's an alternative to God right now. You guys are all waiting to reconnect with God, go back to Israel, rebuild the base of Mikdash. I am the alternative, he says. That's what he tells us. I think many struggles that we have in life, on a religious level, are the same exact struggle. Are there alternatives to God out there? I mean, as Jews, we're supposed to believe that God's in control of it all. Nobody can usurp God's power. Nobody can run the world other than God. We look around. Again, initially, the challenge was idolatry. Instead of focusing on God, they focused on idols. So the idol is alternative to God. So nowadays, we're not tempted by idols. We have our own idols that we're tempted by. You know, we're in the midst of the election season, as we all know. And many people look at politicians. You know, they have all the power. You know, they're in charge. If you take it too far, you're saying there's God, there's alternative to God. There's a president, there's a king, there's an emperor, the prime minister, and they're able to make decisions that go against God. That's not a Jewish belief. The Jewish belief is that even the decisions made by politicians essentially are controlled by God. There's a verse we say, Leiv Malachim Yad Hashem, the hearts of kings are in God's hands. And when a king makes a major decision, we're supposed to understand this is actually a message from God, not based on his own personal policies. Obviously, if we do our best to choose the right politicians, then we have the responsibility to put forth the best human efforts possible to do what's best for the world. Ultimately, if we ascribe to a politician too much power, then we're looking at them as an alternative to God, like Achashverosh. I'm the alternative. So no one goes this far nowadays. No one's going to make their own temple and do what he did. But it's the same concept. You know, some people will look at money as an alternative to God. You know, money is power. Money controls everything. And when we get too money hungry, then we can say, well, there's God, but there's money. You know, and money is what controls it all. So it's, again, it's looking at it as an alternative to God. It's only if you take it too far. That's how some people go that far with it. There are times in history where Jews got sucked up into many ideologies. I don't think you have as much anymore, but you go back 100, 200 years, many Jews, you know, the best of the communists were all Jews. You know, the founders and the strongest communists were all Jews. And those Jews were the ones who were not religious Jews, but they took on these ideologies as an alternative to God. Forget about religion, but we have communism now. You know, and these ideologies sweep people up and take over. And again, ideologies are good, but they're good ones, but they're good, but they can't be in place of God. It's not that, okay, I believe in this ideology, and therefore I don't need religion. It could be that, you know, I believe in God, and I think this ideology would fit what God wants out of the world. That's a fine thing to say. To say that this is going to overtake God, I mean, that communist ideology, so certainly the Soviet Union was in place of God. They were atheistic officially, and everything was in place of God. You know, we're going to take care of you. Forget about God. We take care of you now. And we're going to, the society will cover you from cradle to grave. That's what they used to say. So I think that we do have, you know, we don't have an Achashverosh, you know, setting up his own personal temple and wearing the temple garments and using the temple vessels. We do have things in life which sometimes pose to us alternatives to God. It's our job as Jews to say that nothing is alternative to God. Their God is controlled at all, and then there's things which happen in the world which we have to do what God feels is right. But never think that anything else has power that can usurp God's power, overtake God's power, be a replacement for God, an alternative to God. That can't exist. But Achashverosh's goal was clearly that. Based on the words of the sages, his goal was, I want to become a replacement for God, I want to usurp God's power, sit on the throne of King Shlomo, and make my palace into the next temple. That was really his goal. I wanted to share with you one additional thought about Achashverosh, which is very much ties into the theme we've just developed. The sages tell us, in the very first verse of the Megillah, so it says, Vayhi me Achashverosh, is the days of Achashverosh. Hu Achashverosh, he was Achashverosh that ruled, from Hodu to Kush. So, it repeats his name twice in the first verse. It says, is days of Achashverosh, he is Achashverosh. So why is it repeated twice? So the Talmud tells us that it's a comment on Achashverosh throughout his life. It says the same Achashverosh that was wicked in the beginning of the story, he was wicked at the end of the story too. He's wicked the entire time through. I mean, don't think that when he experienced the miracles of Purim, he's married to a nice Jewish girl, he's good friends with Mordechai, who was the greatest rabbi of the generation, he witnessed the miracles of God through the Purim story. And the Gemara Gil tells us that all the people of the land had a new respect for the Jews, for Mordechai, they all wanted to convert to Judaism, it says. It was to the point where the Talmud says we stopped accepting converts because people were just too taken in by this miracle and weren't converting even sincerely. They were converting because this miracle overwhelmed them. So everybody respected the Jews. But not Achashverosh. The Talmud tells us he was wicked from beginning to end. So Achashverosh at the beginning of the story, who Achashverosh? He is the same one that happens at the end of the story. He's just as wicked from start to finish, Achashverosh. Never changed. So you can see a person can go through a lot of miracles, see a lot of things in life and not change, how stubborn we can be, you know, that's one thing. But I also saw a commentary point out a very important lesson. If he didn't change, then why is it that in the story he suddenly does good for the Jews? I mean, if he hated the Jews with such a terrible hate in the beginning of this drive, He wanted to destroy the base of Mikdash. He just couldn't stand the idea of Jews having any power. But we see him in the end of the Megillah, he prefers Mordechai, the second in command of the land. He knows Esther's Jewish and he rewards her for it. And the Jews are having a great time and are happy and are very much cared for in his empire. Well, if he hated Jews throughout the entire story, then why is that happening? How do you reconcile that comment of the sages of the story of the Megillah? So the point, and this is a very important point, the point is that we said before, the hearts of kings in God's hands. And the sages are telling us that don't think Ahasuerus got any better. He was wicked through and through. But when the Jews do the right things, and we repent, and we see God's hand in the world, so even the most wicked of emperors will be manipulated by God to do good for us. So Ahasuerus, deep down, if you asked him, do you like Jews? I can't stand you. I hate them. Let's leave it out. Right? What do you think about the temple? I'll never let it be built. No. Disgusting. Terrible. But the fact he rewarded Mordechai, rewarded Esther, rewarded the Jews, that's because, you know, God intervenes and makes him do things which are good for the Jews, because we did the right thing for the Megillah. The Megillah centers on the fact that when we found out about these evil decrees, we fasted, we prayed, we repented, we committed to the Torah once again. When we did that, Hashem saved us. So the safety, when we got saved, the salvation came through Ahasuerus, even though he was a wicked person. And end of the story, he's still a wicked person. And that never changed. And you actually find the kind of a reference to this, that we spoke about taxes. So we began the story, he charged a tremendous amount of taxes in order to make his crazy parties. And everybody became poor in his days because he taxed them so heavily. And he wasn't starting welfare programs. He was paying for his own personal pleasure. That's what he was doing. And at the end of the Megillah ends, again, as I mentioned before, the second to last verse says that, the third to last verse, it says that Ahasuerus placed taxes on the land and on the islands. What's that? It's a very random point. Let me do the story. But part of that point is that you think that he got changed by the whole story because the kind emperor cares about people now? No, he's still money hungry, power hungry, he wants his tax money. He never changed. What changed was Hashem's desire changed. That made the miracle happen. Yeah. He lowered everyone's taxes at this point because he wanted somebody to confess. Esther's from our people. He's trying to say, look at me now, lowering taxes. If you admit to Esther being from your people, you can't get a greater reward. He's trying to consent to it didn't work. So yeah, taxes are up here. Sure, that was it.